is performed staff or delegation from National Treasury. Is Treasury represented in this meeting? They're not here. Okay, let's hope they're coming. Is CBO present? They're not here. All right. I'd like to send a special word of welcome to the Human Science Research Council. And indeed, I'd like to express a word of welcome to our guests, because in terms of democratic government, even the general public is expected to attend. And if they are here, you are warm welcome. Indeed, I'm looking forward to today's meeting. The objective of today's meeting is to engage with the human society. If we can we be soft, saying that the objective of today's meeting is to engage with the Human Science Research Council regarding the submission on the 2018 medium-term budget policy statement. During this time, the committee engages various think tanks to solicit input and ideas for effective decision making on issues affecting 57.7 million people, especially the 6.2 million men and women who are without jobs. So it's against this background that the committee invited Human Science Research Council as a critical stakeholder. The HMRC is a statutory research body established to inform the effective formulation, monitoring, and implementation of government policy, and to stimulate public debate based on scientific research. So let me then allow to welcome Science Research Council for always coming to bring insights to us and also assisting us to come up with solid and concrete recommendations for the House. So I'm looking forward to a fruitful and a constructive engagement. Thank you very much. So we'll then move on to item number two, which is apologies. Are there any apologies? All right, Minister Jobaza, and then Honorable Member Shobekwale. Okay, Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. I may need to leave earlier. I want to go to the health policy presentation next.
Thank you for coming. This time you need to start before you go. Thanks. You need your presence. You need a lot to listen to. All of you. Then let's move on to item number three, which is presentation by the Human Science Research Council. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We were unable to load the presentation on the... I hope, Chairperson, everybody has a hard copy in front of them.
I just want to double check. We all have the hard copy of the presentation.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd like to express our appreciation for this invitation and to say how much we enjoy doing this homework for this committee. We have quite a bit to say, Chairperson, and so I'm not going to delay unnecessarily with an introduction, but I would just very quickly like to introduce our colleagues down the line here. Professor Nanya Bola-Muller, Professor Lightness Tindai, Dr. Vijay Reddy, Professor Ivan Turok, and Dr. Glenda Kuss. And each of them will take responsibility for a portion of this of this presentation. We're going to essentially try to answer the request that was made by the committee, which is to do an overall assessment of the medium-term budget speech, to do an assessment and analysis of the allocative efficiency, to look at the challenges and opportunities, and to offer a general assessment of what the speech is all about. We're going to begin and straight over to Professor Turok, please. Over to you, Ivan. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Graham. So I'm going to highlight a few key issues from the medium-term budget policy statement and then make a few comments on them. So I think I'll start with the statement by the Minister of Finance that South Africa is at a crossroads, he said in his speech, as you remember. In various ways, we've faced some important choices about the economy. We face a very challenging situation. And the statement revised downwards the growth forecasts from 1.5% for this year to 0.7%, which was a bit gloomy, but perhaps not surprising in the context of the recession that's happened in the first half of 2018. So if we look back over the last decade, we see that economic growth has only averaged 1.8% over that period. So somebody else has described this as a missed or lost decade, and I think there's some truth in that. If we had simply tracked other emerging economies, our economy would be 30% larger than it is at the moment. So we would have another 30% population in employment, and corresponding benefits all round. The NDP, you'll remember, talked about an average of 5.4% GDP growth per average per annum. So we're well behind where we need to be, where we want to be. The unemployment rate has risen recently, last week, to 27.5%, according to the latest data. The expanded definition, 37%. So these are clearly big problems that we face. And the effect of this relatively slow-growing economy is that GDP per capita average income in the country has been falling because our population growth rate has been higher than the economic growth rate. As a result of this, the tax revenues are down by $27 billion in 2018-19. Which is clearly a challenge in terms of public spending, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. But low growth basically does create problems for our social contract, for our fiscal framework. It reduces our ability to spend. It requires selective tax increases, and we saw that in the budget earlier this year, the VAT increase, very unpopular, but considered necessary given the state of the government's finances. Now, particular weaknesses that have emerged this year have been in our core productive sectors of agriculture, mining, and manufacturing, which has been very concerning. And the net result of all of this is that we have about 30 million people below the poverty line in the country, below the normal definition of the poverty line. So a number of things have been heading in the wrong direction and really need the government to take some important decisions about how we address these challenges. In the next slide, I show the figure from the statement showing the budget deficit rising above the target to 4%. That was sort of considered by many observers as a kind of critical indicator of the state of our finances. 4% of GDP is our public debt and what we have to borrow to meet spending commitments, and that will carry on at about 4% for the next 3 years. The effect of this is that we have less money to spend on social programs, basically. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. The next slide shows another key indicator, the government borrowing in relation to a total public debt in relation to GDP. And again, this shows that this proportion is rising over the next 3 years against sort of general hopes that it would start falling now, but it rises to 60% in 23-24. Now, some sort of international comparisons are quite useful here because these figures are always hotly debated. You know, is this, how bad is this level of debt? And there was a piece in yesterday's Business Day by Neville Machetla saying that India's at 58%, India's at 66%, China at 58%, Brazil at 93%. So compared with some of the other BRICS, you know, our 59% where we're heading is not that bad, and it gives us some scope to borrow more. But Russia is down at 20%. The average for middle-income countries, 52%. So, you know, these are all sort of debate points, but I think the general consensus is that, the lower the figure, the better, because it gives you, you're not spending on paying back the interest. You've got space to spend on social programs. You're meeting your real priorities as a government. And indeed, my next point on the next slide is to show that our debt service costs, in other words, what we're paying on interest, is rising from this year being 14% of tax revenues to 15.1%. So we are spending a little bit more over the next few years on simply servicing the debt rather than on meeting real needs. And indeed, the next quotation taken from the statement, debt service costs are the fastest growing category of expenditure, crowding out social and economic spending. So these are sort of important lessons that we need to take into account. And debt service costs have been rising at nearly 11% a year compared with 7% for the rest of government spending. So we're spending more and more on interest payments, and that's really not sustainable. And we have to do something about that. But of course, precisely what is very, very difficult. So roughly a third of our total spending is on wages, public sector wages. That's been, again, another big source of debate
Among political parties and observers. You know, is that sustainable? That spending on wages, and so on. A third of the spending is on transfers to households from other entities, particularly social grants and other forms of social spending. So that's good spending in relieving poverty and helping households to cope with the difficult economic situation. The effect is that public investment on infrastructure is being squeezed, and this is really what we need more of to facilitate economic growth and economic infrastructure, spending, roads, electricity, water, and other ports, and so on, to enable business to grow. The spending priorities announced in the statement are nothing new, but clearly about reducing poverty and inequality, increasing employment, and promoting inclusive growth. Now, the next thing is really quite important, the next point on the slide, that basically, spending on basic education at 15% of the total, public health at 12% of our total, grants at 12% of our total spending. These are all rising slowly in real terms, so that's quite important. You know, we're not making poor people pay the price of these economic challenges. Basically, we're spending over the next few years slightly more on these important social programs. So we're kind of trying to protect, governments trying to protect the poor from the austerity and the economic slowdown. So that's a positive thing, I think, in the circumstances. Other priorities, clearly, to improve the efficiency of spending, to increase government capacity, and to improve the governance of some of our key state entities. The next couple of slides just simply show this, dig down into the point about public sector spending, wage spending, a little bit more, because the sort of common perception among the man in the street is that increased spending on wages in the public sector comes about through employing more people. In fact, the increased spending on the public sector salaries comes about more through the increase in the average salaries paid to existing staff, not by employing more people. And it also comes about through promotion. Right, so these are different issues. It's about, do we encourage public sector employees to moderate their pay increases, that should help, rather than slashing public sector jobs. Okay, so that's the sort of dilemma that government faces at the moment. Let's turn to infrastructure for the last couple of slides before I hand over to my colleagues. So there's a figure there showing the decline in public and private investment over the last decade. And that just is quite worrying, that particularly the private sector are spending or investing less. And of course, this again has been another big issue for the country. How do we get the private sector to get out of their investment strike, putting it simply, and invest to help it grow the economy? Some people blame some of these things on self-inflicted damage caused by the government. In other words, lots of red tape, too much bureaucracy, making it complicated for private sector to invest. So I think that's a big agenda to move forward. It's kind of low-hanging fruit to try and facilitate private investment by streamlining some of the regulatory burdens on business. And other issues are more serious. So public investment in infrastructure has been a big theme for the last 5 years and more. How do we boost public investment in infrastructure? And the key message of the statement is a special fund to improve the quality of government spend by improving the preparation of infrastructure. So ensuring that government is better able to prepare and plan ahead infrastructure spending so that we don't end up with underspending or we don't end up with overspending and we don't end up with projects that are not really what we need. So that's a really important initiative. Obviously it's not something you fix overnight, but this central facility in government to improve infrastructure spending is a very good idea, it seems to me. Efforts to fix the poor governance of SOEs, and we read a lot about that, led by our brave Minister for Public Enterprises, and this is clearly a very, very important issue for cleaning up state entities. And again, restoring confidence in ESCOM, in Saudi Airways, Transnet and others, so that they can borrow, so that they can function effectively, and keep their administered prices within limits that people can afford and business can afford. So another big theme of the statement is private investment. And this, I think, has prompted a lot of discussion. The talk of a blended fund. How can public and private sector partner together more effectively so that government doesn't have 100% government spending that can lever its resources to get additional resources from institutional investors? Very, very important issue. And a lot of work is going on there in terms of building these partnerships. Because other critics say it should be privatized, state entities, and so I think that's a big issue for the committee to think about the best way of leveraging private investment into infrastructure. And my last slide is around short-term policy priorities. So three short-term priorities are flagged in the statement: policy certainty and investor confidence. I think that this is extremely important. The mining charters, trying to do something about that in the minerals sector, renewable energy, clarity with the integrated resource plan, the public procurement bill, trying to simplify and clarify policies in relation to procurement, BEE requirements, and so on, in order to facilitate a small and medium enterprise, particularly on townships, to compete for public sector employment. Panel on land reform, another area, the tourism visas, another area in which the government is trying to simplify, streamline, reduce uncertainty to make it easier for the economy to expand. The second area is around strengthening public institutions and the state entities. I've already mentioned that, so I won't go into it. But clearly a very important immediate priority for government. And the third one is on the partnerships for growth. Business support for local procurement, employment tax incentives, youth employment service, small business innovation fund, and the infrastructure fund. These are very, very important in sort of short-term initiatives to try and stimulate more investment, more expansion, more development, and industrialization. And then I think what my final point is, there are uncertainties, and many commentators on the statement have raised big questions about beyond these short-term priorities, you know, what is the government's agenda to get the economy moving and growing and developing more rapidly? What are the structural reforms that are really top of the agenda in terms of really transforming our economy and our society in order to really make a bigger impact on the economic problems we face? How do we really shift from consumption to investment? How do we really attract much more foreign direct investment? How do we shift the part of the economy to labour absorbing, labour intensive forms of growth rather than capital intensive manufacturing industries? Right. So these are the really big questions. I think we don't get too many answers. And perhaps that's not surprising, but I think we should be asking these questions. How do we really transform and not just stimulate in the short term the economy? Because we do need transformation. We do need much more employment in the way the economy grows. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will continue with the next few slides related to education and skills. And in terms of trying to think through this presentation and looking at the environment of limited economic, low economic growth, limited resources, how then to answer the kinds of questions that you've asked us in the letter. And I thought, and I want to use the lens of going beyond just the budget and the money and try to look for efficiencies and possibly different ways of doing things so that we still have to improve education and skills in the country. Otherwise it becomes a vicious cycle. So in this few slides I want to take that kind of lens. I also recognize that there's multiple imperatives and multiple demands. And all sides are very important. And so it's about managing tensions, managing dilemmas, and I've listed some with respect to education and skills. On the one hand, do we support equity and invest our resources in the poorest and the groups that need it the most? But we also have a challenge to invest for excellence and to pull the whole system up and the economy and leadership, etc. So that's the one dilemma. Then do we support higher-end skills and higher education fraternity, or do we support foundational skills and your grade R and primary schools? In terms of the economy, and Ivan referred a bit to this, and in terms of stimulating the economy, is it high-skilled jobs that we would like to have or the low-skilled jobs? And then in terms of the current growth about the world economy and the technology development has taken a major role, and with the technology development there's automation, and those require high-end skills. So do we go, which pathway do we choose, the high-end skills, technology, automation, job losses? At the same time, how do we stimulate with the economy for with labor-intensive growth rather than capital-intensive growth so that we do absorb the large numbers of the unemployed, the majority of which whom have low skills? And somehow I was trying to think about the words to the song, you know, you can't have one without the other, and I can't remember the first bit of the words. And so in these dilemmas, there are no choices. We really have to do both sides of it, and so we need to find ways on how we respond to the both sides of the imperatives. On the next slide, I looked at the speech of the minister, and I would like to comment on four things. One is the adjustments for school infrastructure backlogs, and in his speech he refers to eradicating pit latrines at schools. It's very sad, I think, that a crisis and death is what creates a whole lot of the emotion and then, you know, a reaction to that. But anyway, while in the in the budget speech earlier in the year, there was a drop in infrastructure budget, and that was move towards the National Skills Fund. Now we've in the adjusted budget, there is a budget towards infrastructure and eradicating pit latrines, and I'll talk with that about that. Then with regard to education, the speech also refers to school safety, a major issue, and we see the number of videos around. But more than a budgetary issue, it also requires attitudinal and behavior changes for school safety. The third thing is to talk about the overcrowded skills policy environment, and like there are many initiatives to look at how one reconfigures cabinet and the different government departments. In the same way, if we take the same argument towards the skills policy environment, so and the speech talks about policies must be clear and consistent. And the fourth point I want to talk about is the silence on skills development to support technologically driven fourth industrial revolution. Not necessarily believing in, but a lot of what the president's speeches and in terms of various government departments, they have mentioned the fourth industrial development and technological growth. The speech talks largely about industrial growth. So just those are the four points that I want to provide some evidence about and raise some issues around it. In the first one is the basic school infrastructure and home infrastructure, and those two sets of tables refer to that. When we look at schools and looking at the change of the infrastructure from 2011 to 2017, at the moment, in the 2017, 45 schools have no running water. In 2017, 72 schools have no electricity. The no toilet, sorry, I think it's a misprint there, should have been 40 schools, have no toilet and sanitation facilities. 37 of those schools are in the Eastern Cape. And so while there's 40 schools with no toilets, if you actually drill down further into the sanitation issues, there are 4,624 schools that do not that use pit latrines. And that constitutes about 17% of the 26,000 schools. And so it's not just about having sanitation, and it's human rights violation not to have those toilets in the 37 schools, but it's also that while they may have schools, and look at the one chart and the long, the VIP latrines, there's various kinds of latrines, not all of them are water flushed toilets, and so that would also require that change from the pit latrine to a water flushed toilet. And it's interesting to also look at households, because we find that if we look at inequalities, the inequalities start at the home and continue to the schools. Those in the homes that don't have water flush toilets probably also go to school then. So we have this compounding effects of water of inequalities. And with the household itself, and again, it's important to sort of compare over time to see that there have been changes occurring. And that what you know, on the one hand, things have changed from, in this case, to 2003, but there are still challenges. And so when we look at electricity, sorry, these should have been in percentages, so the numbers are all in percentages, that if we look at the households with electricity, and what we also try to differentiate there, because we had data from learners in schools, those learners that attend fee-paying schools and those learners that attend no fee-paying schools.
Sorry, just a point of clarity, I don't know if it's the right thing to have.
Well, procedurally, we normally leave them to, and then at the end, then, so that we don't disrupt the flow of the presentation.
Yeah. Okay? So those learners that attend no fee schools, 12% of them come from households where there's no electricity, whereas those that are attending fee-paying schools, it's 4%. In terms of households having running water, two-thirds of learners from the poorest 60% of schools have running water, one-third do not have running water. And if we look at water flush toilets, again, household toilets, it's just 44% of the poorest learners, or the 60% of learners, have water flush toilets, and over half of them do not have water flush toilets. And so these, as I said, the inequalities from the household then repeat itself from the inequalities in the schools. What numbers? Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm looking at 2015 no seat schools. That's locked there. So 88% of those households, so the children that are in the no seat schools, about 66% there, 88% of the children who attend no seat schools have electricity at home, so 12% don't have electricity. And then,
and remember, see, when you talk about the food, then you have two letters here. So
oh, both of
them.
Oh, okay. So, okay, sorry. Okay. Sorry.
Sorry, I just wanted to go back to that. I'm a little bit concerned whether the stats is correct, because you're talking about 2016 schools with no electricity is 569, and 1 year later it dropped to 70. Are you saying that in 1 year we've gave an additional 500 schools electricity? It would be very good if we did. But likewise on the other one, on using pit toilets, 9,200 to 4,600.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that we go, we don't go in a discussion.
Okay.
No steps.
Yes.
So that
okay.
When
yeah. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll get back to it.
Okay.
On the same point. We're going to get back to it.
Okay.
Okay, maybe we can go in
terms of the households, apologies, but what I've been basically doing, the number of 88 and the percentage, so the subtraction from 100 minus 88, and with running water, 64% of the households, of children who attend no-fee schools, do have running water, and therefore the 36% have no running water. And the households that have, for children who attend no-fee schools, 44% of them do have water flush toilets, and therefore 56% have no water flush toilets. And again,
now, do you follow how you do it?
Yeah.
I mean, they jump into the difference.
Yes, of course.
Yes,
on the next slide, so the issue about infrastructure development for schools relates to the CD project and the Accelerated Schools Infrastructure Development Initiative. And I know that, you know, for years we've been following the debates around CD projects and the school delivery and the delivery of schools, etc. And the debate has always been whether this school infrastructure development is managed by the Department of Basic Education or whether it should be managed by Public Works. And so while there's been a great deal of infrastructure development, with this latrine, pit latrines, etc., and because it also involves not just about construction of a pit latrine, it involves the construction of, it's got to be on a sewage grid. And whether this last bit of work that needs to be done and how that is managed with the public Department of Public Works, and so we're raising that as an issue that which hasn't you know, I think the minister pointed to Minister Mosheka in the speech, but it's not the relationship between DBE and public works is a very important one. The next one, the next point that I would like to deal with is the issue of school safety, which again has been raised in the budget speech, and we've seen incidences of school safety or school violence, I should say, and it's becoming a, whether it's because we have the technology to communicate it more or whether the incidences are increasing, we're not sure about, but it is about the school safety issues. Now what we want to just point out to, school safety is not just affects the physical well-being of people in schools, but rather, but in addition to that, it does affect achievement as well. It affects learning, it affects a whole lot of things, and what we've done on the slide on the left-hand side is to correlate the levels of bullying in a school with the mathematics achievement. And if we look at the axis below, the x-axis, you will notice a zero in the middle. And so we created a scale, and the minus sign means an increased level of violence and bullying in the school. And as you go towards the positive, it means less bullying in the school. And clearly the diagram shows that this relationship, the more bullying there is, the achievements are very low, which is on our x-axis. Sorry, I had a pointer to sort of show these things there. Should I do that on the slide? I've got a pointer somewhere there.
The bullying and school violence is not just affecting, as I said, the physical well-being, it affects the cognitive well-being of people as well. And so on this axis, we've put down what the mathematics achievement for. And on this axis, we have the extent of bullying. So we've got a zero here. This means that if you take the scale and increase bullying on this side and decrease bullying on that side. So you see that when there's high levels of bullying, the scores are very low.
Mm.
And similarly, as you have less bullying in a school, and when the kids are not bullying each other, the achievement scores increase. So further to that, on the diagram, I just want to point out that in no fee school, for the school, the color is blue. There's more bullying, there's more levels of violence within the school itself. The scores are also lower. I mean, it's not the only factor that affects the achievement, but the level of bullying and affects the achievement scores. And here you have in the PK school less violence, less bullying that's occurring, and their achievement scores are higher. And so, again, like you said in the beginning, it's sort of beyond, going beyond the budget, and there are sort of attitudinal and behavioral changes that we can encourage, and of course the bullying in a school is a reflection of the society and the levels of violence in society itself, but these are ways of one of those factors that also influences if we have better achievement, higher levels of education and skills. And on the right-hand side, from our research, you know, we're promoting that the elements of school climate include all of those things, that we respect the voices of students, parents,
our schools feel welcome in a school, the issues about equality and social inclusion, and I was reading the newspapers this morning around the Rustenburg school and feelings of not feeling the social inclusion, safety and health, and developing leadership. And I think the issue about leadership is a massive issue, and leadership in institutions do matter. And these are things that not necessarily budgetary related, and so respect, safety, inclusion, and care are also the kinds of attitudinal changes that we should promote in order to get better environments of schooling. The third issue that I want to raise relates to policies and regulations impeding delivery, and that's there. And again, Ivan also referred to many of our policy documents talks about policy coherence, policy coordination, policy alignment, and that there is a tendency for over-regulation which impedes rather than facilitates delivery. Now, we recognize the importance of good governance, but it might also be that we've so over-regulated that we've impeded delivery. And in the 2015 OECD Economic Survey, while they refer to trade and investment, shows South Africa, if you look at that diagram in the red there, sorry, I just picked up a call in Cape Town.
Okay, what is OECD?
The Overseas Organization of Economic Cooperative Development, yeah. So the European organization.
Developed countries. The Organization of Developed Countries. It includes the US and European, West European countries.
I think
I was just trying to add, it's not the European organization, it's an organization of developed countries, including the US and European countries. It includes Japan, I think it includes South Korea as well. Thanks.
And it's based in Paris, and it's one of those surveys that they do a number of comparative studies, and they've highlighted the high barriers, regulatory barriers in the various countries to trade and investment, and we see from this that South Africa has a high level of regulatory barriers. And what we did was, in a study that we did for the high-level panel last year, in a study that we did for the high-level panel last year, where we looked at the influence of legislation for service delivery, we mapped out the policies that relate to the post-school education. And so that very pretty, colorful diagram... Oh, you've got it black and white, sorry. And so that diagram, what we looked at the main policies and the National Qualifications Framework Act and how it interfaces with various other acts for skills policies. And the point that we wanted to make out of this is there's such an institutional sprawl that it actually leads to a delivery crawl, and that's what we called it in our report. And if we could go back to sort of look at the issues of coordination, coherence, and alignment, and get that into a better framework, it again leads to better efficiencies. My time is almost up, but I'm just going to go very quickly on the last set of the last issue, which is that the budget refers largely to industrial growth and not to technological growth. But yet it is, we have no option as a country but to also look towards the growth of the artificial intelligence sector, the fourth industrial revolution, and the various sectors. And the diagram on the left tells us, this is an example from the U.S. sector, but how the different skills and the changes in skills from 2002 to 2030. To 2030, And the skills that, the kinds of economic growth that will occur means that you're going to have far more technological skills and less of physical and manual skills. And the budgets don't refer to the sort of how are we going to support the growth on these skills. And just very quickly, the next slide tells you the kinds of jobs, fourth industrial economy, the kinds of skills that are needed, the kinds of jobs that are needed, and the sectors in which there is going to be growth. And there, in order to prepare for that sector, there's going to be a whole lot of skill training. And I think that I'll stop at that point. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson, and honorable members. I will present on health. Basically, in July of this year, the HSRC released results of the 2017 National HIV Survey, which shows that the HIV/AIDS epidemic is still continuing unabated. So from the survey that we conducted last year, we were able to estimate that the total number of people living with HIV in the country is now 7.9 million. This is 14% of our population. Compared to 2012, when we did the last survey, it means an additional 1.6 million actually became infected. That is most disturbing. And why has there been this increase? This is not to suggest that there are no there's no progress that is being made, because essentially you have to recall a lot of people are on treatment and are living longer, so they are not dying. However, there are still new infections which are still taking place, and that is the problem. Although overall, as the slide shows, there was this drop in the cases of new infections, what we call incidents. Overall, the trend has been going down since 2008. However, we still see a relatively sizable increase in new infections, particularly among young people. Something that really changed was the fact that this time it's even happening amongst young males. Up to now, the problem has been mainly among young females. Let's move on to the next slide. So basically, the gains which we have achieved by putting many of those living with HIV on treatment are sadly being reversed by these stubborn cases of new infections, particularly among the young ones. And particularly males this time as well, because for the first time, prevalence and incidence has also increased among this age group. So when we move over to TB, we know South Africa also has one of the worst TB epidemics, which is partly driven by HIV, because the two diseases go together. And it's been estimated almost 349,000 582, which is about 1% of the population, of new cases were diagnosed in 2012. And this is a number of about 1,003 out of 100,000 people in the population. This is an extremely high figure of infections which are detected each year. Why our information is slightly outdated is because we are currently out halfway, almost about to finish the first ever national TB prevalence survey. The results, we expect to finish fieldwork in March, and the results will be available next year. So, overall, in terms of HIV/AIDS and TB, we'll keep emphasizing that the government must be commended for continuing to fund the bulk of our national response as far as TB, HIV and TB is concerned. So if there is a way of classifying our national response, the one is the happy face, which shows that we are responding in kind. We have the largest burden in HIV, but we are also putting in the resources that are required. As a result of that, there has been an improvement in the life expectancy, again, solely because of the effective use of treatment, so that we have slowly seen a growth in the life expectancy from when it had dropped down to as low as 50, now it is at 70 years, or we expect it to reach 70 years, hopefully, in the next few years. If we need to win this battle, clearly resources are critical because part of the national response is funded through donor funding. Essentially, what is needed is, we feel, the bit that is missing from the puzzle in terms of our national response. We're doing well in terms of biomedical prevention. For example, treating the disease itself reduces the level of infectivity of those living with HIV so that they do not pass on the infection to their partners. This is a biomedical way of really controlling the disease. But beyond that, we do need to work even harder to look for other ways which are mostly what we call structural, which are drive the more social and cultural factors that are also known to drive the epidemic. In terms of the, if we move to the next slide, the health allocation, overall there have been an increase in the allocations. The increase has mostly been associated with infrastructures, relating to hospitals in this case, the national health insurance, paying of health workers, including allocation of posts for medical graduates. With HIV now being mostly a chronic illness, people are not dying at the same level as 10 years ago when we didn't have a public health-run treatment program. There is now a greater need to invest more resources in emerging non-communicable diseases, that's what NCD stands for, that among the top causes of death in South Africa today. For example, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, cardiovascular diseases, and cancer. In fact, cancer is now killing more people than does HIV in the country. So we need actually to allocate more resources to that. The next slide, members, honorable members, I think you have seen this slide before. What it does highlight, basically, it shows what we call a concentration index, which is used in studying of inequalities in health. And basically, the idea is that if a value is zero beside any of these aspects of healthcare, it means that it affects both the poor and the rich equally. When a value is negative, it means that it is more common among the poor, whereas when it is positive, it shows that it's more common among the rich. So if you look at the spread of these numbers, across the continuum of healthcare, all of the negative outcomes, all those numbers in red which have got a negative value next to them, suggest that they are more prevalent among the poor, while those with the plus sign, which are more positive outcomes actually, are more common among the rich. So basically, this basically shows that health inequalities in our country still remain stark and extensive, and hence why we need the national health insurance. Let's go to the next slide, please. This is my penultimate slide. So these socioeconomic gradients that exist across the different dimensions of healthcare access actually provide us with evidence of the continued inequality in a critical state of South Africa's healthcare system. And it's really the rationale why we have adopted the National Health Insurance as a way of addressing that. So we need indeed to find ways in which to still provide for adequate funding in order for the National Health Insurance to be implemented. My last slide, which is the next one, I'm sorry if I'm rushing through this. So it's important again to acknowledge that there have been many healthcare programs that have been developed and are currently being implemented and even scaled up throughout the country. And examples of this include, among others, the integrated school health program. Then recently we have also had the implementation of the sugar tax. And also currently there are proposed changes in tobacco control. It is nice to have all these programs being implemented, but it is also advisable that we do evaluate their impact sooner rather than later. Perhaps as we implement them, we should find resources to be able to determine their impact as well. Of course, another example of other programs, particularly in the HIV sector, has been that quite a bit of money has been spent targeting young girls. That's a wonderful thing, but we are saying based on the new results we got, let's not forget the young boys as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Chen. I'm from the research program called Democracy Governance and Service Delivery at the HSRC. So we'll be focusing on the item that you've asked us to see, which is capable and skilled public service, and some of the highlights of the new finance minister's speech. So it's divided into various sections. We'll begin with context, and I think this is quite important. We have something called the South African Social Attitude Survey. It's a longitudinal, nationally representative survey that's been running since 2003. We won an award for our data last year. It's part of the International Social Surveys Program. And so we have some really interesting data around public perceptions. Different areas of governance performance is the first slide. And we really need to look at this context in order to understand how we can better develop a capable and skilled public service. In terms of social grants, interestingly, the public has the highest level of approval for social grants, but this has dropped by 5% since 2010. We have you may have access to all of the data that leads to these conclusions. Secondly, in late 2010, about 70% of the adult South Africans registered satisfaction with management of education. Since 2010, there has been a 12% drop in satisfaction rates. Water and sanitation has received fairly consistent ratings between 2003 and 2015. Since 2010, there has been a 7% drop. So you'll see 2010 is featuring quite a lot here. Satisfaction with access to health care slowly on a downward turn. Between 2014, there has been a drop. Between 2014 and 2017, there has been a drop in satisfaction by 8% of the population. You will see in part the fifth part at the top there, the public is mainly concerned about jobs, crime, and housing. And that's not really that surprising. And so we can see drops in satisfaction in those areas, but these are serious concerns that are coming through on the survey since 2003 and increasingly concerned about jobs, crime, and housing. Then land reform has received low levels of public approval. In 2017, only 21% of South Africans were satisfied with land reform, and you can see a large drop there, 12% from 2010. The next slide is public perceptions of service delivery per se. This is just pulling out some of the highlights of the survey. Limpopo and Mpumalanga, Western Cape and Gauteng are more satisfied with access to basic services than those in the Northwest and Eastern Cape. And I think it's clear that Northwest and Eastern Cape to a large extent are in crisis. Those living in formal urban areas and formal rural areas are more satisfied than those living in traditional areas and in urban informal settlements, as would be obvious. The wealthy and reasonably comfortable are more satisfied than the poor and the very poor. And whites and coloureds are marginally more satisfied than black Africans. The next slide looks at trust in the political system from 2003 to 2017. We can see that there has been a general decline in public confidence in parliament, national government, and local government. Trust in Parliament has dropped from 65% in 2004 to 25% in 2017.
All right.
Sorry to say.
If I may stop you there. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of mumbling again. You know, I just want to make sure that we all are reading from the same page. There's a noise coming from the three gentlemen, mm-hmm. and then this lady here also, you know. I heard.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know. So can we assist you so that we move
Sorry, Chair, we just our systems couldn't accept the information that is here. It's so shocking.
Your system, eh?
Us, with what we've just observed about politicians and political parties.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Also, Honourable Member McLaughlin, it's also your system, eh? Honourable Member, your system as well. And you, ma'am? System. Okay. No, that's fine. We've just discovered that systems are responding to this presentation. So may I request that we control our systems? Let's proceed.
Yeah, sorry. It's a bit of medicine. It's a 40% decline in public trust. In terms of Parliament, national government has declined. By 41% in terms of trust. About 28% of South African adult population trusted their local government in 2017. This is down by 55%. So that's even larger. Local government is really less trusted than even Parliament and national government. South Africans don't trust political parties and politicians, generally speaking. Sorry about that again. And then trust in local government by province shows that the Western Cape fares at 44%, which is not ideal, with the highest level of trust, Free State, with the lowest level of trust at 16%. Corruption is a concern to South Africans, and the reason why I'm touching on this is because it really came through strongly in the minister's speech. Just to say that the number of people concerned with corruption in South Africa has risen by 21%, and that is now at 31%. Just aggregated there, the Indian and white populations are more concerned about corruption. Those with the tertiary education are more concerned. I'm just running very quickly through that. And people in urban areas are more concerned about corruption than in rural areas or traditional areas. It's interesting to say that in traditional authority areas, there the rate of growth has been from 6% to 21%. So it's been quite a high rate of growth in the traditional authority areas around concerns about corruption. All right, so looking at that in context, how are we going to address capacity constraints and weaknesses in municipalities? That's the core phase of service delivery, and again, something that the Minister spoke about quite a bit. According to 2018 speech, municipalities owe more than 23 billion in arrears, including to Eskom and water boards, and are vulnerable to liquidation. You do know that. The 2.5 billion allocated every year to provide extensive support to build municipal capacity is welcome. However, there is an urgent need to monitor skills capacity and its impact in municipalities during the 25-year review of local government that is being conducted by the DPME at the moment. There is also a need to conduct a skills and capacity audit to understand what is happening at entry-level, mid-level, and senior-level municipal officials, and to inform training and capacity interventions. So we really need evidence-based interventions here. As mentioned then, in terms of service delivery challenges, there is a move to look at the functions and powers of the Minister of there's a growing scope of government functions and a declining institutional capacity of the municipalities, which calls for the review of the powers and functions as set out in sections 84 and 85 of the Municipal Structures Act of 1998. And we do know that there has been a call by COGTA to look at these two sections. So to ascertain how amendments to the MSA would facilitate a differentiated approach to the structure and functions of two-tier local government to enable the creation of a single-tier government, the province that's been really pushing for this is Gauteng, to look at wall-to-wall metros across the province to ensure effective integration of municipalities in order to meet the challenges of urbanization. The next slide, repositioning and professionalizing local government, again the coal face. We need a bit of dynamism, innovation in terms of attitudes, responsiveness, and the understanding of developmental local government. Do people understand what developmental local government actually is? We require a blueprint for best practice in terms of implementation and guidelines that respond to the NDP and the domestication of the Sustainable Development Goal. The integrated development plans in terms of the inclusivity is a problem. The public still feels as if there's not sufficient participation in terms of the IDPs. And there also needs to be reports to government around protocols and in terms of implementation plans and a phased-in approach, although this doesn't mean that we must do this slowly. We would just work in phases. And then the last aspect that we have done research on that came across very strongly in the minister's speech was state-owned enterprises, and we know that the president spoke about this yesterday as well. Research has been done on this, and I think I've mentioned it before to this committee, and we really do believe that we need to revisit the research already conducted to track the implementation of the 31 short and long-term recommendations of the Presidential Review Commission. that took place quite a while ago. I think these recommendations were published in 2012 or 2013. There's specific recommendations that could be looked at initially, that the mandates of SOEs should be subject to critical strategic review every 5 years. So we can't just leave the SOEs to carry on as they wish, and this should be factored into the State-Owned Enterprises Act. Transitional SOEs Reforms Committee, Executive Management and Monitoring Task Team must be established to drive the implementation of these recommendations. The proposed State-Owned Enterprises Council of Ministers and the central SOEs authorities should develop customized human capacity building programs. And the last one is the recommendation 28, where government should develop an integrated reporting, monitoring, and evaluation capacity for SOEs across all spheres of government, because there's a tremendous amount of fragmentation in terms of this. And thank you, that's all I have.
Very interesting. Especially the last part. What you say, you think it's new, but it has been there. There's a requirement for the petition court to be able to do that. So, yes, it's a great thing. But I know we all can hear it.
Colleagues, thank you. I head the Centre for Science, Technology and Innovation Indicators, and we work very closely with the Department of Science and Technology. One of our big projects is to measure the expenditure and the human resources that are devoted to research and development across South Africa, whether in the higher ed sector, the science council, government, private sector, and the non-profit sector. So when we looked at the budget speech and thought what would be useful to highlight this year, because in past years we've talked about, you know, are we reaching the target of 1.5% of GDP being expended across the system on R&D and so on, what stood out was a growing concern and awareness of the importance of sustainable development. The Minister spoke about some of the constraints being posed by problems in the water sector, the issues of renewable energy, and the rollout of the carbon tax. So we thought it would be useful to share some of the data on that we've been doing on green R&D. And I think Ivan Turok stressed very significantly the importance of water, energy, and in infrastructure development, and increasingly there's a recognition that we can't promote economic growth at the expense of environmental degradation, and we need to be aware more of a sustainable development path. So what we're trying to see, and I'll move to the first slide, is how well equipped is the system across the national system of innovation to have the levels of investment in research and development that will equip us to address these challenges going forward. So we started off with a definition of green R&D, and essentially it's focused on new or significantly improved products and services that will reduce negative environmental impact and optimize resources that lead to sustainable development. We've seen that in our industrial history shows that there's a long history of involvement in green trade, in the motor vehicle equipment manufacture,
environment and agricultural research, increasingly mining activities and energy generation. But we also see that there's a potential for employment creation through green methods in agriculture, biogas, water treatment, power generation, biocomposites. And these have opportunities for social and economic development. So how well are we doing in South Africa? When we looked at the data since 2010-11, the size and value of the green economy itself has been growing. When we look at our most recent data on the R&D data, we're seeing that the investment in green R&D activities accounts for some 8.2 billion, which comes up to 0.2% of GDP. And if we think that we're spending 0.87 of GDP on R&D, on domestic research and development expenditure overall, that's quite a significant expenditure. And it represents 25% of our total domestic expenditure on R&D. If you look at the graph at the bottom of that slide, it's encouraging to see that around from 2011-12 onwards, there was an increase in public sector spend on green R&D. And if we look from 2015-16, we're seeing that there's now an upward trend in the private sector. And I think that points to ways in which public sector spend can leverage and encourage private sector spend. But overall, there is a steady increase in green R&D expenditure, which is a positive signal. But are we doing it in the right fields? So the next slide looks over time at the field in which we invest in. And we're seeing that running from 2010-11, 2011-12, so on, there was quite a lot of investment in the applied sciences and technologies, and that's tapering off. But the agricultural sciences are increasing in 2015-16. And particularly the social sciences have increased, and we do know that a large part of the social science investment is research and development in economics, but the issues of green, the green economy and green human development are significant and are becoming clearly a bigger issue in the social sciences in general. And when we look at R&D expenditure, we look to what extent is it addressing key socio-economic objectives. And this, again, you can reflect the largest socio-economic objective that we're addressing is plant production and plant primary products, which remains oriented to the agricultural sector. And I thought I should just point out, and animal and primary products. So the largest part of green R&D is promoting agricultural socio-economic objectives, and we could raise questions about is there sufficient research and development on energy, because on energy resources and energy supply, which is below animal production, it's very it's a very small proportion. And environment on the left-hand side, environmental and other aspects, and environmental aspects of development are also quite a small proportion. So it suggests that we need far more R&D to be focused on the energy, water, and renewable energy sectors. And then if we look at the type of research, we know that basic research is very important, because without basic research we cannot have the foundation for applied research. Over time, I think there's a steady increase in basic research in the green R&D field, which is positive. There's a very strong increase in applied research, which again is also a positive trend and an encouraging trend. So, in short, if we look at the national spend on R&D, the gross domestic expenditure on R&D, our latest survey, which we released last week, the 2016-17, shows that there's a 0.87 6% of GDP is spent on R&D, and our national target is 1.5. So clearly we're not spending enough on R&D across the national system of innovation in general. And what we've tried to show here is the need to promote more R&D on critical fields that can promote environmental sustainability. Thank you, colleagues.
No, I just want to say thank you very much, Chairperson. What we've tried to do here is to do a big analysis of what the priorities that are emerging in the budget, what they look like. And we're trying to put those priorities against an analysis of what the country is going through in terms of the challenges that we are experiencing. And it's been an attempt to, if you like, draw on our own work, work inside of the HSRC, to draw on syntheses that we are doing of work that is being conducted both in government and from our colleagues in the universities, and to give us a sense of both what we're doing well and what are now really big issues which we should be paying our attention to. And so it's a very important thing to say that we are, and we must acknowledge this, progressing in some fronts, but we are struggling really badly, and there are danger signs in a number of sectors. We see that in the education analysis. We see that in the health analysis. You know, we see that in public perceptions, and that is a really important indicator. And it's I think necessary for us to say that we come here attempting to be helpful in terms of drawing attention to and commending where we are doing well, but trying to draw attention to where the critical areas are. We're quite happy to take comments and questions. Thank you very much, Chen.
Okay.
Resources. Much as we want to hear about value for money, also we want to get value for money for these meetings and also to make an impact. So on that one, it's an objective I think you have achieved this morning. Thank you very much for the presentations to all the professors in this house. We are very lucky. Doesn't always happen that you get a lot of professors just to pump wisdom in our heads. So we really appreciate this. We cannot ask for more. This rich information that we've received this morning. Our members, we've received the presentation from HSRC, well-researched presentation, and I mean, research is about applying maximum objectivity, looking for, searching for information, and then coming up with findings. So today they've also shared with us their findings in their work. And interesting was that some of the hard facts that were put before us triggered some responses, you know, spontaneous responses from honourable members to a point where I had to control it. You know? But thank you very much. I'm trying to show you the impact you've made with your presentation. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm going to open the floor for you to reflect and interact with the presentation. Thank you very much. Anyone who comes up, let's agree, to become short and to the point, so that we can have enough time for them to respond, but also enough time for members if they've got more, you know, follow-up questions and also want some more bites on the presentation. Short and to the point. Thank you very much. Honourable Member Imam, Honourable Member Shackleton, am I right? Yes. Who else want to come in on this one? Honourable Member McLaughlin, Honourable Member Martins, and Honourable Member Snukwanyane, Honourable Member Manana, you can see the response. Honourable Member Gwabaza. Thank you very much, in that order.
Thank you, Chair, and...
Thank you, Chair, and allow me to thank you for your presentation. While you put us into a state of depression, but it was awesome. Thank you. But can we just have some clarity first before I go on my questions on page 19? I'm just not sure if your steps is correct, because if it's too good to be true, and that's what I'm worried about. Basic school and home infrastructure. I mean, you say no electricity in 2015. Each year, you'd find it dropped by about 1,000. Suddenly, it can't drop by 500 in a year from 2016 to 2017. No electricity, no toilets has reduced, but if you look at using pit toilets, have dropped from 9,200 in 2016 to 4,600, surely. Are you saying that in 1 year we've 5,000 toilets were sorted out? And that's, I just wanted some clarity on that before I go. And particularly electricity, so 569 schools had no electricity in 2016, and 1 year later, only 72 of
yes, control this meeting. So let's get all the questions.
Okay.
And then all of you note down
okay.
questions that would have relevance to your presentation. At the right time, I'll give you time to respond.
Okay. Thank
all
you.
Right. Thanks for that question. Are you? Do you have another
one? Yeah. Okay. I have a question.
The first round, let me confine you to three questions. No, I knew. Come up. Let me confine you to three questions and I'll give you another bite.
Okay.
Three questions?
I think then I'm going to decide to choose which one. One of the issues that I find that we might not be addressing, particularly, say, on the 15 to 24, and you're correct, there's an increase there. There is a massive move to key populations. In a survey, and I attended a conference a few weeks ago, and we found that the HIV prevalence and new infections, I was shocked because they're asking us to support it, 57% was through key populations of men having sex with men. And if you then look at 15 to 24, which is an increase in the boys, you can see where it is actually coming from now. So I'd like you to tell me if you're looking into that. If not, if we could rather look into that, because 57% here was men having sex with men. Another 20% was sex workers. So almost 80% of your infection is there. And the question is, what do you believe we should be doing to address that? And incidentally, while I was doing that, we went to our rooms for the night, and when I went back and I went and did a survey, I did some research. And you'll be shocked what I found. I went through all the towns in one dating site. No, I'm being honest, because I had to deal with them because they're asking us to support this, and I wanted you to convince me that I need to support it. And you'll be shocked what I found. In some of the areas like PE and some of the areas, more men are looking for men than men are looking for women on the dating sites. It's becoming a serious challenge, and we're not looking at that seriously. And that's why your infection rate is increasing to the extent it is. I'm very interested in something that I've been very passionate about before. And in my view, the three-tier government is not working. So I'd like us to comment on that. The second tier, particularly the provincial ones, are not performing. I don't know what purpose they really serve. There's limited mandate for national departments. They can't do anything about it because a lot of these things are provincial mandates. And it's a great problem. So I'd like you to guide me. I'll just go to the last one for now. you talk about salaries and things, and we're talking about reducing the wage bill. Can you tell me how do you anticipate we can do this? Because on the one end, let's assume it's not about increasing the numbers anymore, right? But we have to increase the salaries in line with inflation, because the cost of living is rising all the time. So you can't keep it at that level while the cost of living is rising. So what do you suggest that we actually do there? Because it means the standard of living of these public servants particularly are going to drop. So I think if you can just for now. Yeah.
Thank you very much for the question. Number two.
Thank you, Chair. I think most of what I'm going to say is comments, actually.
We could remark perhaps that the correlation between mathematical skills and violence, when you look at yesterday's fracas in Parliament, perhaps some people aren't as good as maths as we once thought. Yeah, there was. I was just making a joke. But I think looking at the infrastructure spend and as well as the spend on education, I think it's clear we can't solve problems by just throwing money at the problems. I mean, I think wherever we go, pretty much in South Africa, it's not very hard to drive or walk to a place where they've literally never had running water, they've never had proper sanitation. And I think in all of these things, proper adequate monitoring is what we really need to see what we're getting out of it. We had a different presentation where it was pointed out, for example, that the highest percentage of the wage bill nationally is spent on education. But we all know that education stats in our country aren't very good at this point. And I think that also correlates to municipal grants, that there are stories with smaller municipalities getting essentially enough money that they would need to develop infrastructure in the area to provide basic services, but they lack capacity, say, in terms of engineers to actually implement what would be needed in those municipalities. So I think across all of these things, we do need a way to monitor what's actually going on, because really it's time. You know, I mean, so many years after our country gaining democracy, there are still numerous backlogs where we haven't improved the lives of our people to a significant extent. And just a thought on the green economy. There are municipalities such as the city of Tshwane that's essentially gone paperless, where we won't receive reports, say, printed like this, where you won't get agendas printed like this, but you'll only be able to access such electronically. And perhaps if Parliament or certain parliamentary committees could pioneer that would initiate a mindset where we would think about what more we can do towards the green economy as Parliament itself, but I think for the nation as a whole. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Say on the green economy in Tshwane, see, any change must not be radical. It must also take into consideration those who can't access or can't use, you know. So for now, it means they are excluded. And the transformation policy is about taking those who are excluded also on board. So you'll have to find a balancing act there. But it's fine. It's just a comment. All right, next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks to the HSRC for their work. As always, we appreciate the new insights they give us into a lot of what we know already, but they tend to pick out certain things that just give us a few new frights. If I can just ask a few questions, please. I don't want to give a speech, but I'd just like to know, you speak about 30.4 million living below the poverty line on slide 5. What do you regard as the poverty line? Can you give us a very sort of exact and succinct, what are you talking about? What is the poverty line that we can understand the same thing you're understanding from your slide? On slide 6, I didn't understand slide 6. On that graph there on the left, you have percentage of GDP running from 20% to 28%, but the top you say budget deficit rising above the target 3.6% of GDP to 4%. I don't see where the 3.6 and 4% and 4.2% are on the graph, because the graph ranges between 22 and 28. Perhaps you could just explain it to me. Maybe I'm being a bit behind the curve somehow, but I wasn't able to follow quite what we were looking at on the graph as compared to the table itself. And then, if I look at graphs 11, our pages 11 and 17, we can refer to them together, because they both refer in a sense to the same thing. We're talking about this managing technology development and automation versus labor-intensive growth to absorb high numbers of the low-skilled unemployed. If I look at the 2017 column, it looks like what's happening is, if we take the, I don't have colors on mine, so it's the range from 20,000 to 30,000. That's grown extensively since 2006, whereas the bottom one, 0 to 10,000, has shrunk. So we have this rapid increase in middle management with this huge shrinkage in the people they're actually managing. So we've got a lot more managers and a lot less people being managed. This doesn't seem ideal to me. There seems to be something dysfunctional here. My personal feeling is that we have a huge middle management structure that's basically useless. They're doing nothing. And they could be trimmed down by a huge amount, because that is where a lot of people get employed where they shouldn't be employed, because they shouldn't really be there. They're not really doing anything. I don't know what your comment is on that, but it just seems to me that that speaks very much to what is spoken about on slide 17. And then lastly, if I could just speak about, as I've been answered on slide 19 one. This graph you show us on, so this slide is not numbered, but it is, it's number 22, I think. Policies and regulations impeding delivery. These OECD, the economic surveys, highlight that regulatory barriers to trade and industry investments are high. Can you sort of flesh that out a bit for us and tell us what these barriers are? Because you speak about regulatory barriers, but can you give us a little more so that we have a better understanding of what you're referring to? I mean, it's a nice generic sort of term, and it can cover all sorts of things that we might not actually be aware of. If you could give us a little more on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your question. Honourable Member Martin.
Thank you, Chair. Since the medium-term budget, we've had a number of presentations from various agencies and organisations. But I must say that the presentations that we had today from the HSRC, all the presentations not only spoke about the medium-term budget, restating what the minister said, but it's the first time that I had a sense of people interrogating the budget, stating where we are at present and what needs to be done. In some of the previous presentations, there's been a restating, the minister said this, the minister said that, but not a critical analysis of what has been articulated. So for myself, today's various engagements, they deal with different aspects and problematize those various aspects and give members of parliament the necessary analysis to deal in the forthcoming debates and to highlight various issues in regard to the strengths and weaknesses of the budget and where we are as a country presently. Thank you.
Just to reiterate, that is the benefit of belonging to this committee, Mr. Martin. It is this committee, it is only in this committee where you can find so many academics giving us this free lecture. You must know, we're not paying for this lecture. Right. So it's an advantage, an added advantage. Thank you very much. Shall we, the next one? May I have the next one?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much, HSRC. As usual, you always, you know, outdo yourselves. I just want to add my voice, really, to appreciate the presentation, because it's a type of presentation that takes us forward, and we're able to actually identify issues of importance. Maybe I must start with something that's already been addressed, because I was going to ask it, but I'm not going to ask it now. But my colleague, the Honorable McLaughlin, spoke about the issue of the wage bill, because I was going to raise that as well, to check if you have looked at, in fact, I mustn't say if you have looked at the fact where the serious problems are, the bloated upper level. Because if we hope to achieve service delivery, obviously you would need people that are really going to be up there. But I see this as a situation where senior people are just in too much, in too high numbers. Coming to my question, in terms of your spending priorities, you've correctly mentioned the fact that, well, that also speaks to the wage bill, but I wanted to just say that the issue of infrastructure being squeezed out, and I agree very much with you that the infrastructure is being squeezed out, but I just want to ask a question. In terms of the infrastructure implementation, issues of capacity, you know, because it's not just the allocations, but I think in many instances we do have challenges around people who are supposed to implement them, incomplete projects, and so on, and it's one of the biggest concerns that I would want to speak to. The next thing, maybe let me choose which one, yeah. The other thing that I would like to speak about is the issue of that slide, that study that you've done in terms of the math versus bullying, quite an interesting one. I've never thought about something like that, because thinking about this performance at school, I would look at other things like school management, leadership, discipline, teachers not coming to school, and so on. But it's actually by way of commenting, but then just a little rider to say, besides mathematics, what's the performance like generally at the schools where they bullying, whether, because some learners do not necessarily do mathematics, but I must say it's quite an interesting thing. And that was my second one. So my third one would be in terms of HIV infections. I saw that the rise in the increase in the incidence of new infections. What would you associate this with? Is it because our programs aren't making the necessary impact, or is it because we are actually identifying, because it's quite a concern that we have so many new infections, because I was thinking that people have been adequately educated around the issues of HIV. I will end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation. 2 points of clarity on health. On slide 31, we are saying with HIV mostly being a chronic illness, is now a grave need to invest more resources in the emerging other NCDs that are among the top causes of death among South Africans, and including diabetes. But in your presentation, you talk about cancer. Can you elaborate on this? What is the cause of this cancer problem? That was on slide, I presume, 32. Health inequalities across the quantum of health care access. Here we are indicating the illness, the ill health that has contributed to the poor and the rich. I don't know whether post-traumatic stress, or let me take the mental ill health. Are you classify it under the rich or the poor? Because to me it seems as if now it cut across. But the issue of the wage bill has been asked with regards to the grant that is being established, the National Health Insurance Indirect Grant for Bed and Laundry Services. I don't know whether we have ever make a study with regards to this, because most of the hospitals or clinics in the different 8 provinces, the shortage of linen and bed. Maybe if you have any information with regard, you can share with us on that issue. Oh, the last issue, Chairperson, is with regard to the debt. Therefore, it's with regard to the antiretroviral drug. I don't know whether, are you aware that there was a report in the previous or this financial year where there were shortages of it in different clinics. Clinics in most of the provinces where there were no drugs for the pigeon. And, yeah, what are you saying about the relocation of the resources with regards to that?
Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I go to slide 5? I'd like to associate myself with the question that Honorable McLaughlin asked about what is the poverty line. But I want to go further and say that there has been a number of government actions that have sought to cushion the poor from economic pressures, such as, for instance, the No Fee Schools, free school transport, school nutrition, social grants, 6,000 liters of free water to the indigent, RDP houses, and so on. To what extent have all of those things put together relieved households from such economic pressures to the extent that they would be able to live slightly either on or slightly above the poverty line. Has there been a study to look into those things and because that would tell us whether all of these measures are inadequate, just besides the issue of unemployment, because it's there, it's part of in fact it's a major problem that gives rise to people living below the bread line. I raise this question because there was a suggestion from one of the institutions that we consult with to say that perhaps it would help to increase the social grants by 10%. And that was about 2 or 3 weeks back when that suggestion was made. I'm asking, has these things not assisted at all? What more should government do to lift these 13.4 million people out of this kind of situation? Because these things that I'm listing here were part of the cost, household cost at some point. Of course, situations have changed over time, but is it possible to look at those? And if you have, give us an idea of how these have assisted, and to what extent should we then move forward and propose something new or something additional in order to lift these people above that line. The second question, Jefferson, is on slide 14. SOEs. The issue of appointing new boards of SOEs, especially those which have been found to be on the wrong side of behavior. Initially came through as the solution. The MTPPS says look also at restructuring them. And you make mention of that in one of your slides. Here you're pointing us to the presidential recommendations of the Presidential Review Commission as part of the solutions. Is there anything else that needs to be done? Because you can appoint new boards, you can restructure. We still might not be able to solve those problems. I say this because we thought new boards would come with new solutions, turnarounds and all of that. SAA is the case in point. Nothing new seems to be coming through. No hope of a turnaround. Few others are having new boards now being appointed and so on and so on. So what more should be done, and urgently? Lastly, Chairperson, on slide 24. Number three. Yes. Yes, it's number. Yes, it's number three. Yeah. On energy. I can't recall. No, is it slide 24 or something? On energy. Oh yeah. It's not on energy, it's on yes, on slide 24. You correctly observe that things like green economy, the blue economy, are issues that perhaps need to be and skills associated to that needs to be things that should be focused on. The MTPPS, however, is rather quiet on those things. Is it perhaps a shift of focus in terms of those sectors of the economy that should help stimulate the economy? Because the green economy ocean economy are very sector specific. Operation parties are generally broadly very sector specific, but not much is being said about that. Are we shifting focus, departing from those, or perhaps it was some kind of oversight, or are we satisfied that we are doing well there? There is no need, therefore, to make mention of that or to prioritize those in the MTPPS. The worry could just as well be that if they're not being part of the MTPPS mix, the job summit and the stimulus, the funding thereof could be under threat as well. Thank you.
Three from me as well. I think it's Professor Mula. No, that's fine. In your presentation, Prof, you touched on, I think, inefficiencies in spending. I would like you to elaborate on the spending efficiencies. Because, you see, this is the opposite of what we want to see. So, but what is it that you think, you know, should happen for us to have efficient, you know, to talk about efficient spending, all right? And, again, I think this was Professor Revy, who also spoke about internal efficiencies. So as you respond to spending efficiencies and then also touch on the internal efficiencies, what are those? Because all of us sitting here, I'm sure we agree that all these problems that we have, they emanate from inefficiencies, ineffective and inefficient spending. All right, and then again, I think it was your good self, Prof. Mula, who said we also need to focus on transformation and not just on stimulation. Transform and stimulate. You know, please link the two for us so that we gain deeper insight on this one. I thought this was interesting for me. But as you respond to this one, is one question. You also share with us your reflection on the MSTF, Medium Term Strategic Framework, vis-a-vis the Economic Stimulus Plan. Is the Economic Stimulus Plan replacing or is it augmenting? If you could just share with us that, because already we have this MST which was adopted, but there's a new clarion call by the President on the Economic Stimulus Plan. So how do the two, you know, talk to each other? I think I'm giving you my three questions. All right. No. The third one. The third one is, can, this one's to the CEO. Can you, maybe if you can, you can't respond to this one now. When you go back, can you go and, from your critical analysis, give us the impact of the, remember we're talking midterm budget and we are talking adjustment, né, from the February the budget. So can you give us the impact of this adjustment on the division of revenue bill? When I say impact, it will be both positive and negative impact, and the impact on the appropriation adjustment bill. Does it make sense? The impact, just the impact, to be both negative or positive, both negative or positive. And today is Wednesday. I don't know how long it will take you.
Position asked, can I be directly behind it? Are you able to give the chair
a sense? Okay, impact. Because we want to see if we are making impact. Because if you adjust because you've done your situational analysis, and you think if you change things this way, it will yield these results that we all would want to see. Which results of which should be an improvement on the previous plan. Okay. No, that's fine. No, it's three questions. Thank you very much. We will then hand over to you to respond. And also, if I may appeal to you, to in your responses be short and to the point, so that allow members, you can see they really you've increased their appetite for more knowledge in these matters. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Chair. I'm going to ask Professor Turok for us to start with him with the economic questions. There are about four or five, and if we can then go on to talk about the education questions and health and then the infrastructure and green economy, please.
Am I going to be
nice? Thanks very much. So the first question I'm going to deal with is about the three spheres of government not working well. I think Sheikh Imam asked that question. Particularly the provinces. So I think there are two points I want to make. The first is that we talk about intergovernmental relations, but we don't carry that out in practice. So we've got to think harder about intergovernmental relations. Now, so we have silos within spheres of government, but we also have silos between the spheres of government, right? So that, in my view, is something about leadership at the top. It's something about the role of Parliament in holding different spheres to account. It's something about the maturity of our governing members and our officials, and about egos and managing egos and preventing fiefdoms doing their own thing. So it's partly about the culture of the public service, I think. And we need to think harder about that. You know, public servants rather than people with abusing and exploiting their power. So there's big issues there about culture, and I'm going to come back to that in response to another question about what more can be done in a second. So that's one thing, getting intergovernmental relations, a more mature, more cooperative relationship between spheres of government. I think they're on, make a specific point about provinces where you have strong metros with a lot of capacity, as in Gauteng, as in KZN, and in the Western Cape. I think there is quite a good case for saying, actually, we've got a lot of duplication in these three regions of the country, and that perhaps the role of the province should be reduced to being responsible for the parts of those provinces where you don't have a metro, right? Where there's a need for more capacity in rural KZN, in rural Western Cape. The provinces should focus more on those areas and get out of the way of the metros who have lots of technical capacity. And I think that would be a good outcome to see. There was a question then from yourself as well about the wage bill. And there are two basic approaches to this. One is attrition, so basically not replacing people when they leave and saving the money that way and hoping somehow that departments can redeploy people to fill those vacancies that are not being filled. That is the sort of pragmatic approach to it. But of course it's an ideal approach is a more strategic approach where there are decisions taken. For example, reducing the size of the cabinet, reducing the number of government departments, and finding ways of saving costs that way. It seems to me that's really important, and not just to go for the easy route, which is attrition, because that can lead to unfilled vacancies in really important areas of government service delivery. There was questions about the poverty line. Let me answer that. So there are three poverty lines that Statistics South Africa uses and which this data comes from. The data of 30 million people refers to the upper poverty line, which is about 1,100 rand per month, 1,100 rand per person per month. So it's the upper bound poverty line. It's not the bread line. It's not the basic food hunger line. All right, so it covers basic needs. Can people afford clothing, shelter, transport, as well as food? Is the key measure there, and it's not people going to bed hungry at night, which is a lower poverty line and would cover fewer people. It's meeting basic needs. That's the answer to that question. There was a question about the graph and why there's a disparity between the text and the figure, and the reason is basically that the interest spending is not included in the graph. Okay, interest says excluding interest spending. So when you add in interest spending, it amounts to 2 or 3% of GDP. You get to those figures of 3 to 4% of GDP. There was a question then about the number of people on the different salary scales within the public sector. And the reason for that is not so much that there's been a loss of jobs at the lower level, it's more that people's salaries have been rising above inflation. All right, so more people have fallen into that bracket because they have been getting better pay. And this will come to another question later on about efficiencies. And basically, salaries have been going up at about 2% above inflation in the public sector. All right, so one response would be, we're not going to force people to take a cut in salary, but we're going to hold salaries in line with inflation rather than give relatively generous increases from year to year across the board. Maybe you want to incentivize really good performance, but not everybody. In the context of a difficult economic climate, maybe you encourage people to make that sacrifice rather than to go for massive slashes in staffing in the public sector. Okay, so then there was a question about infrastructure implementation, and that's a massive issue, of course, the implementation of infrastructure. We've seen quite big cost overruns in some of our big, our train would be a perfect example, originally budgeted at 10 billion, I think, went up to 30 billion within the space of 4 or 5 years. So we have to be much more disciplined, I think, about that. And that's a huge discussion, of course. How do we improve our capacity? And I think the government's recognized the issue, I would say that, and is trying to do something to improve preparatory work on projects to ensure that, you know, all the ducks are lined up in advance, and that will help to ensure that implementation is smoother. Then there were a couple of questions from you that directed at me. What's the impact of government, you said, on poverty? And the short answer is it's been very substantial. So social grants in particular, but other measures too, such as free housing and disability grants, pensions, have had a massive impact. And without those mechanisms, those measures, poverty would be much worse in South Africa. There's no doubt about that. But remember that when I said that this poverty line of 1,100 rand a month, that is above, well above the child support grant. That is roughly at the level of the pension or the disability grant. So if these grants are being shared among the household, which they are, we know in many in most cases, because it's the whole household that's poor, so that would dilute the benefit of these grants because people are sharing the resources, and therefore it's not lifting those people above the poverty line I mentioned. So it's having a big impact on absolute poverty, but it's not solving the problem because it's a serious and large-scale problem. We basically need more people in jobs in the long term. It's a point about the governance of SOEs. I think I want to make 2 points about what more needs to be done. I think the first thing, we've got to get over the culture of silos again. You know, you hear lots of stories of SOEs not cooperating with departments that are supposed to be supervising them, you know, conflicts, different agendas. We've got to pull together, and I think leadership is critically important. Getting government as a whole to work together, to cooperate, not to pursue different conflicting agendas. So the culture and behavior are really important. The public service, not extravagant spending. There was a question about this from yourself, Chair. Not, you know, fancy Mercedes-Benz, not ministerial, you know, fancy hotels and all that. We've got to recognize that we're in an austerity period and we all have to tighten our belts. And that, so that's one area, sort of unnecessary, wasteful, greedy spending. But I also want to give you another really good example of ineffective and inefficient spending. Okay, so I've been doing a lot of work in a township in one of our cities where there is a serious crisis going on, all right? So to bring it really vividly home to you, the municipality in this township is spending 1 million rand a month on jetting the sewers. Okay, because this is a very densely settled township, jetting the sewers, putting high-pressure water down the sewers to clear them every month because there are more people living in that township than it was designed to cope for. If that spending would to increase the size of the pipes, right, to accommodate all the sewage going down the system, would cost 3 million. Instead, we're spending 1 million rand a month just on jetting the sewers. So this is sort of, it's firefighting type of spending rather than investment in a bigger pipe. Then you'd save 1 million rand a month if we had put in a bigger pipe, right? Another sort of classic example, glaring example, we put in a transformer, electricity transformer in this township. It costs 80,000 rand to provide electricity for people living there. But because of the lack of governance in the township, and it goes back to what my colleague was saying about poor trust in government, because of the poor governance and the lack of confidence in the municipality, people are tampering with the transformer to steal electricity. They also pressure on space. They are living right next to the transformer. That's dangerous. It's full of oil. It could explode and people could be killed. The city is spending is quarter of a million rand to provide a steel cage around the transformer. All right, 3 times the cost of the transformer itself. This is inefficient, wasteful spending in response to a governance problem, right? And this is what we need to sort out. If we had more trust in government, we could spend on investment in productive ways, not in totally inefficient, wasteful ways, and that would be much better for us going forward. You asked a question about stimulation versus transformation. Stimulation is about increasing, putting it simply, the quantity of activity, more economic growth, more GDP, all right, more income, more activity, transformation is about the quality. It's about doing things differently, not ensuring that the rich and the wealthy cream off the bulk of that income. It's ensuring that it's distributed more fairly. That's what we have to do more, not just to recover and turn around the economic growth rate. We have to shift onto a different direction where the bulk of our society benefits from that growth. You asked the final question about the adjustment. This requires a lot of research and analysis. I need to think harder about that. My gut feeling about it is that a lot of the adjustments are about ad hoc changes in response to particular bits of underspending, particular opportunities or particular issues that have emerged, like the pit latrine issue, which require emergency spending and to be moved in a particular direction. So I don't think you would see any real significant improvement or deterioration overall, because it's an ad hoc adjustment rather than a strategic, we move in this direction because it's going to have a significant impact on growth and development. That's my gut feeling about it. If I haven't looked closely at the detail, it would require going through all the separate items and trying to make some adjustments. We don't do that kind of modeling in the HSRC. Other organizations are better equipped maybe to give you a bit more authoritative answer. Thank you. Sorry to block.
Let me respond to some of the education questions. apologies for putting figures on a graph and just not having enough explanation on it and not explaining the differences properly. So on the question of the infrastructure figures, the school infrastructure figures we got from the Department of Basic Education, who submitted to DPME for their 25-year review. Now, I've looked through different figures, and the slight differences in the figures that different parts use, but in the main, for it's similar for now. The Equal Education uses the figures from the Department of Basic Education as well, but I could go back and re-look all the figures and perhaps come back and give you the sources on each one, if I may. I also want to link it to the question that was the infrastructure question that was asked here about how the implementation works. Now, to just give a story, last week I went to one of the primary schools around Durban, Duff's Road Primary, and there they told me the story about having to build a block, one more block for the school. And this development has gone on for 7 years. And each year, there's a contractor, there's money given to the contractor, there's non-delivery. And if we talk about internal efficiencies, that's why we're saying it's not only about the money that's there, but the usage and the internal efficiencies. So for 6 years, there's been this incomplete block, but there's been payments made by the municipality to build these schools. And so this whole, I mean, it also then links to the kind of culture that we have in the society and how the money is used. So that is a real story about not money being there and corruption and other things, and it's not used. The second question about the OECD economic survey. This was a report that was commissioned by National Treasury, and I could give you the link on it. And I'm not a trade and investment person, but I just read from here the kinds of what the OECD has said about it. How to meet the investments in infrastructure, lack of infrastructure investment in the electricity sector, transport infrastructure have not kept up pace with economic development, telecommunications could better support growth, better business regulation to boost growth, housing and spatial planning for urbanization. And I just found, as I said, I was trying to use the concept of the regulations impeding skills development surveys. The delivery for skills development.
And what we were trying to refer to there, and again sort of linking to the question of the chairperson and efficiencies, and so this becomes a governance issue again. And in our attempt for better governance, have we created too many policies that then, there's a question of alignment, there's a question of coherence, there's a question of coordination. And when we analyze in detail, and we have the reports that we can also send to you, the skills policies, you have the regulations themselves impede the kind of delivery. And just sort of linked up to that, the 2009 administration talked about joined up government, again about internal efficiencies. But it again has gone back to a very big government and siloized processes that therefore you go to a certain part and you can't go any further. So this notion of governance and coordination, and it was something in the work that the Department of Higher Education commissioned us to do on the labor market, intelligence partnership and skills development, one aspect was about governance and how to look at policies for better delivery. And the question of math achievement and the effects of bullying. It was very interesting when Minister Mosheka first heard this. She was also, we don't make those links, but it's, you know, then when you think about it, of course you're in an environment when you can't learn. And she instituted, and you know, it was a stimulus for her to institute better safety policies. But maths is basically the proxy for education quality, so it does refer to all of that. And so, and to the question, the last question relating to skills for the technological growth and its silence in the budget. And the reason I put this in there, because I know a number of the president's speeches and other speeches, and you open the business reports of the newspapers and they talk about the fourth industrial revolution and the artificial intelligence, automation, etc. And so I don't know, but the speech speaks about manufacturing sector and industrialization, and whether government has decided that they would rather have the investments in manufacturing, because the growth of the manufacturing sector in most countries leads to better growth in the country. And while we will be going through these different sectors, the blue economy, and Nanya can speak more about it, and the other economies, and these are high-end skills, whether then it is private sector that takes the responsibility for the growth of those skills, and government in terms of a more inclusive growth going for manufacturing. But whatever it is, it would be nice to have, as a layperson reading the newspapers and listening to the speech, then that there is this coherence between different parts of government on how these skills investments will take place on that. So that is what is trying to get us. And of course, recognizing, just coming back to this sort of smaller government, etc., or joined up government and coherence, of course it will lead to further loss of jobs. So I mean, the unintended consequence of all of this would be further loss of jobs, and our 10 million goes up. And so the choices are pretty tough, I think, because there is no one choice. It's going to lead to some sort of consequences there. So those are the points.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I was asked a number of questions. To start with, Honorable Imam referred to the shock of the statistics with regards to prevalence amongst what we call key populations. It is true that the levels of HIV infection are highest among these key populations. He gave an example of men who have sex with men. The other examples are sex workers, people who inject drugs, and you could even add what we call transgender people. The levels of infection amongst them are quite high. However, it is important to contextualize this. The estimates of the total number of people in these key populations are low. Altogether, all of them are less than, are estimated to be under 1 million in the country. So I'll give you examples that are likely, thanks for cell phone, you can ask up-to-date information. The Department of Health and SANAC believes there are about 650,000 men who have sex with men. Right? 650,000. There are almost there are 195,000 or so female sex workers. There are over 4,000 male sex workers. There are 7,500 people who inject drugs, and there are about 72,000 or so transgender people. Those who identify with the opposite sex that they are born with. Some have actually transitioned. So we're talking about a small segment of the population which is highly infected. Yes, that is a problem that needs to be addressed. But they contribute so little to the total amongst 57 million South Africans. In other words, we have to look at it proportionally to their size in the general population. Yes, there are lots of them amongst themselves, but when you look at the global population of the country, they are a tiny minority. It is important that we do address the epidemics amongst them, and indeed there are initiatives being driven by SANAC and the Department of Health. Unfortunately, most of the programs are funded by donors. The bulk of the money comes from PEPFAR, the U.S. government, and from the Global Fund for the Fight Against HIV, TB, and Malaria. So there are programs that are currently running targeting these groups. The point there is that relatively there are many more young people. I was trying to estimate maybe 10 to 15 people, 15 million youth. So we're talking about a fairly large number. So that when you just say 1% of that, you're talking about a large number of people relative to the population sizes of the key populations. I hope that's making sense. So it's just that in the terms of how the disease spread, we tend to see an increase. We started low base among babies. Now we're down to less than 2% infections from their mothers. But this increases, and particularly when we get to youth, it's much higher than their male counterparts. But in the last survey, we saw even amongst the male counterparts, the male youth, we've seen a much bigger increase than we have observed previously. It was hard to explain, but in part we think it might have to do with the fact that we are focusing a lot on adolescent girls and young women. There are many interventions, even funded by our own government as well as PEPFAR, targeting that particular group, because indeed it's where a lot of new infections are still occurring relative to other population groups.
Can I have a follow-up there, Chair?
I know I'm going to give all of you
okay.
A follow-up
question.
Are you done?
No, I was just warming up on so I got four more questions if you don't mind.
Sorry, Chair, my follow-up is on that specific response. The later is going to be new questions again, but this particular one I wanted to follow up on. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Okay, thank you for that, sir. The second question was this issue of new infections occurring. In trying to explain why we are actually noticing an increase, if people are not dying, whoever is infected and is managing the condition should be able to live a long life. But the increase is really due to the fact that although overall levels of new infections are dropping because we have been following a trend where we've noticed from a peak in 2008, the infections have been dropping each year. However, there are some new infections which are still happening. And as we indicated, particularly among these young people, clearly, key populations are also another group of concern. Until recently, there were no programs targeting key populations. So within the past 2 to 3 years, there have been an increase in activities or programs targeting key populations. The third question, actually, let me begin by correcting I think I got really carried away when I was talking about non-communicable diseases. So, essentially, cancer kills more people in the whole world, than HIV. Right? But when we come to South Africa, HIV and TB are amongst the biggest problems. I think I had to make that correction. No, I'm addressing everybody. So the point is really that cancers are a growing problem in our country. Right now, they're among the top 10 killers, if we can call them that way, right? They're within the top 10 burdens of disease in the country. The particular types of cancer mainly breast cancer, lung cancer, colorectal cancer to do with the colon and the rectum, prostate cancer, and interestingly, there's an increase in skin cancers as well. Work out that, I'm leaving some detail. They are noticing there are more and more skin cancers of late. So I needed to contextualize that to say it is a growing problem. It's not the biggest killer within our country yet, but if we don't address that, but if you then add the other non-communicable diseases, then the magnitude of the problem grows even bigger, because then you're adding diabetes, hypertension, cardiovascular diseases, and obesity, as health problems that are common in South Africa. With your permission, if I can then move to the table, to the slide that shows the health inequalities. The question was whether mental ill health and post-traumatic stress disorders, the prevalence of that varies according to socioeconomic status. The answer according to this, and you were correct, is that they are almost equal. If you look at the coefficient, it says minus 0.0. Because they are close to zero on this index, it means that there are only slight differences. The fact that there's a negative is suggesting there's a slight tilt towards the poor, but they're almost the same. Compared to, if you look to medical aid, you will see it's a positive 0.435. It's really tilting to the rich. The same you see about private care, it's 0.254. That's a positive value. Again, it's mostly among the rich. But if you look at the public care, it's minus 0.241, which means that is mostly what poor people have access to. So your interpretation was correct, that with regard to mental health, there are but slight differences. And then the next question was about ART, antiretroviral treatment. I happen to have been the privilege of listening to Dr. Jürgen Piller, the DDG, in the Department of Health about 2 weeks ago, who was addressing the issue of stockouts of medicines for people living with HIV and AIDS. Yes, this did okay in some areas where the supplies were erratic. So the Department of Health and all interested key stakeholders tried to redistribute where they had access that they were supplying to others. However, the main cause, as was explained, because they had their consultation with all stakeholders, was that the stockout had occurred because of a challenge in the manufacturing of the drugs, wherever they are sourcing them from. So it was possible that because of something happening way back in the pipeline, that's where the issue had to be addressed. And in essence, the government could do very little but to wait until supplies improved. So the worry there is that then people missed, in terms of adherence to treatment, because they are meant to take this treatment every day. And if you don't do that for a considerable period of time, you develop resistance to the drug. Then next time when you have to continue, you have to take an even more expensive drug. Yeah, but essentially the issue was addressed by the Department of Health in collaboration with all stakeholders, including networks of people living with HIV. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the responses. Chair, there were some questions from myself and Professor Cruz. May we respond? Thank you. They weren't direct at me, but they were part of my presentation, so I thought that I would just make some comments around the three-tier government and intergovernmental relations. In much of the research that we've done, and this has jumped out, intergovernmental relations is deficient, it's not working. The siloed approach, the fragmented situation is very detrimental to service delivery. And when we speak to residents and citizens about the delivery of basic services in informal settlements, they will say to us, we don't care who is supposed to deliver, we just want you to deliver. Bring the president here. So, you know, that's extremely important, that it's really, really not working. We need to rethink it. If the system isn't going to work, we need to bring some innovations into the system. And life etidemia is the best example of how things can break down here. And I know that the Department of Health, in its NHI strategy, is actually trying to get rid of this blockage that happens at provincial level, but there's a lot of resistance to it. And so I don't know if they're actually going to succeed in what they want to do, because there's, as I've mentioned, you know, Schedule 4 of the Constitution states that health is concurrent when it comes to provinces and national, but provinces at the same time are not working concurrently with government, and in some instances not implementing government policy in the sphere of health. Then the state-owned enterprises, I really do think we've got the research outcomes. It was a multi-million rand project, so we don't want to say that we've wasted taxpayers' money. And I think the most important part of this is really looking at legislative uniformity. Again, not working in silos.
ensuring that we revisit mandates, that there's monitoring and evaluation, and possibly public and private partnerships, because I know that yesterday the President said that if we close ESCOM down, our economy will collapse. So that's just an interesting observation from one of the answers to the questions yesterday. Lastly, the blue economy. I was very surprised, because I'm involved in this sector, very surprised that this was not in the speech. And
well, come again, what was not in the speech?
The blue economy.
The
blue economy. Blue economy. The blue or oceans economy, I mean, we know about Operation Paquita. It must be noted that there is no indication, there are no indications about how many jobs have been created. So the lab was looking at specific sectors, but there's no indication how many jobs have been created. There was a promise made, it was 800,000 jobs over a certain period of time, but we don't have figures, and that's a problem. So we don't know whether it's working or not. So that's the sort of job part, the exploitation part of it. However, the blue part of it is really important. And, you know, when it comes to looking at plastics, we need urgent policy interventions around this. We have a situation where the oceans are becoming unsustainable, that fish now have plastics within them that we eat. So when Canada led the G7, for example, it placed a tremendous emphasis on the oceans and the blue economy. This is happening in Europe as well and in the Indian Ocean Rim Association. So I think government can't drop this off the agenda. It can't, maybe, I'm hoping it was an oversight, because we need to look at it in terms of tourism, you know, job creation, and we need to urgently look at issues around climate change and what it's doing to the oceans, and ensuring that whatever jobs we do create are sustainable, because we are looking at a crisis in terms of the oceans. So I sincerely hope it was an oversight.
I just want to pick up on two points, and the one is to reiterate that our national R&D expenditure is less than 1%, whereas we're spending nearly 4% on servicing a debt. And that's very significant in us falling behind in terms of economic development, technological upgrading, moving towards more knowledge-intensive industries and not being left behind. And the second point, somebody asked the question, what can we do differently with the SOEs, state-owned enterprises? And again, historically, the state-owned enterprises have played a very key role in research and development. But our research over the past few years shows that this has been declining and they're spending less, and they're not doing as much, and they're not foregrounding R&D in their annual reporting criteria as strongly. And this is very significant if we're talking green R&D and economic growth and infrastructure growth, that they are keeping up with the technological cutting edge in energy and water and so on. So I'll just be reiterating that point.
Just one chair. And I'd just like to say that we may not be able to answer it, but it was the question about the laundry. I don't know if you have any insights on the state of the provision of linen in the hospital likeness.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. Other than that, one of the things was that was announced by the Minister of Finance was that they were reprioritizing some of the projects to actually provide for to better build the minimum for hospitals. But something I missed this question. Yeah.
Okay.
That's why I suggest we should have this meeting on a Sunday, Chair. But in terms of my follow-up, sir, my understanding is this. Most of the new infections now, 57.7% is sex workers, 26.8% is men having sex with men and all this stuff. So my problem is this, that the focus of attention has to move in this particular direction. It's a reality whether we like it or not. And we seem not, the department is doing a fantastic job in this, but the focus is not on this main area, which is where it's really coming from. It's not normal men and women that are having sex that is causing this. It's sex workers and the men having sex with men. And you're going to be surprised at what percentage. Now, I'm not sure if the data we're getting is correct, but let me tell you what. Remember, there's a stigma attached to men having sex with men. Like TB, there's been a stigma and people don't come out. Exactly the same thing here. So how do we know, you know, where it is actually coming from? That is why we need to open it up and do more research into to find out how many of them are engaging with men. And like I told you earlier on, if you go to some of these sites, you're going to find more men are looking for men than men are looking for women. It's very frightening. So that's my problem as far as that one is concerned. So I think we need to pay a lot more attention to that one. Now, you know, I'm not surprised. No, I'm going to the next one. I mean, I'm basically got been gagged by you, Chair, that I can only ask one more, but that's fine. I can't force my way, what can I do? But anyway, but I'll restrict it to this one. One of the major problems that I find in terms of the challenges we face, actually, can I not take two? One very other important one. Okay. Because, you see, let me give you a good example. Okay. Yeah, it's very dangerous. It's just that I wanted to talk about one where we have a serious challenge in the country in terms of the economy, and we all know there's challenges worldwide, but we particularly, and let's talk about us. Now look at the self-inflicting wounds that we are creating. Okay, I'll give you an example. Take Eskom. Eskom is now borrowing money from China, but Eskom is owed $13.8 billion by the municipality. Now does it make sense that you have your money here, people are not paying you, and you must go and borrow to sustain yourself? So what are we doing? Something that we are doing is wrong. We need to change that and correct it. And in line with that, if you talk about these where you get service delivery protests and nothing is happening, it is because politics is not today about the people and serving them. It's about us. It's about power. It's about control. It's about the resources. And public representatives, we all report, despite what the systems call for, we all report to our political parties. We never account to the people who pay our salaries. There are people who tell me that we report to the speakers in the ministry. It does not happen. You report to your party, including here. You've got no record of how many people...
You round up?
So it's a problem unless you change the system and get great accountability and make us all understand we are the servants of the people. It's not the other way around. So if you don't change this entire system, you're never going to win this war. 200 billion rand a year is lost in this country alone because of inefficiency, not getting value for money, fraud, corruption. Look at how much we could save. I'll stop there, Chair.
Thank you very much. Observations were made on your overemphasis on the men-on-men sex. And I know you've repeated it several times. I just want to be a springboard to you to say these things don't shock us anymore. I know you wanted to shock us. We've been shocked enough. So our shock absorbers are ready now to receive and receive and process. And as long as at the end there will be an improvement or a turnaround or a solution. So please note that we're not shocked anymore. All right, next.
Ma'am. I'm just going to avail myself of one question, ma'am. Professor Turok, you spoke about the structural reforms. I just wanted to ask, because it's been often said in speeches over the last few years that our problems are connected to the global economic crisis and all the rest of it. But if you compare our GDP growth figures to that of our neighbours, our sub-Saharan neighbours, we're way behind the curve. I think we're probably third or fourth from the bottom out of 37 odd countries. Have you done a sort of an investigation as to what the difference is with those economies and ours, where the fundamental differences lie? Can we not do something to emulate those neighbours who are performing better than we are? Is there not something we can do in that line to try and address the structural reform issue, because it must be something basic, because others do so much better than we do. I can't see that the attractions or the situations they have are that much different to ours. We're all basically in the same geographical part of the planet. Sorry, I'll leave it there. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Next. Thank you very much, Mr. Babaza. And then, any other follow-up question? Okay, then it's a new question from me. Which aspects of the 2018 MTPPS hold the most gains for low-income households? Ne? Then the second one is, other stakeholders such as the FFC and the Public Service Commission have cautioned against underfunding of the public health sector. Has HRSC conducted research in this area, and what are the findings? Okay. All right. On the trust in the political system, in your reflection, what do you think would bring a turnaround? Because trust is needed to take us into the future, into a brighter and a better future. So what would be your turnaround there? Then the last one is, I had it in mind, what is it? Okay, it will come. I forgot to do that. I just didn't write it down. Okay. You may respond.
Thank you, Chair. Again, thanks to Honorable Imam on his further question and comment. I think we are in agreement that the levels of infection among key population groups is high. The issue is really that they constitute 1 million out of 57 million people. Yes, a lot of men relatively are talking about up to a million. Well, I said 650,000. It's an estimate. There could be more, or there could even be less. Yes. So in those groups, yes, the rates of infection are very high, and something needs to be done. But there have been some modeling exercises which have tried to ascertain what contribution they make overall of the curve. It was no more than perhaps a quarter of the new infections that could be attributed to that group. So in summary, basically that modeling shows that the vast majority of the infections occurring amongst those who have sex with the opposite sex.
I can see you want to come in.
I think I'm being misunderstood here. What I am saying is that with the new infections, 57% of all new infections are caused by sex workers and 28% by men having sex with men. So what I'm actually saying is this: if you look at that increase in percentage now with new infections and the direction is moving, it's only a matter of time. It's not about men having sex with women anymore. It's about men having sex with men and sex workers. That is where it is moving. Your statistics you're giving me is based on what happened in the last 20 years or 30 years. Progressively.
So you are saying
understand
men having sex with men not helping the situation.
No, it's not.
Yes,
okay.
True. And we agree.
So
you've made your point. Yeah. Do you
want to respond to that? Because it's an aggravation. So, how
do you
respond to an aggravation?
It's not an aggravation. Yeah. Through you, Chair, perhaps we could engage. We have the data from last year and on the key populations from a year before that. So we could share some of that information with the honourable member. Yeah.
All right.
So on the question of accountability that honourable Mum said, I think my simple one-liner on that would be that we're too top-down and we're too centralized, right? We have to fix local government. Local government is the hands and feet of government. It's close to the community. We have to get our municipalities working better, and we need to focus whole of government on this job. We can't just leave it to COGTA. We've got to take local government much more seriously, seems to me. There were questions about, from Mr. Honourable McLaughlin, about the rest of Africa. It's very hard to generalize about Africa because the performance is very uneven, but one reason is that many of these countries have started at a lower base, so it's easier actually to get a quick growth from a low base. The second point is many of the fastest performers are succeeding through oil and gas exports. Angola would be a good example, but there are others, Ghana too. They found these commodities. It's not a very qualitatively strong form of growth, not a very sustainable form of growth. It's just shipping and digging and shipping your commodities. They've done better than us when the commodity cycle was strong, and we could have done better than that. But so the quality of the growth is not fantastic. But the third point is that some of these countries are doing really good things, like Ethiopia and Rwanda. Most people say these are the standout successes of the last decade and more. And they are one thing they're doing is focusing much more seriously on the economy, right? The government is saying the economy is fundamental. This is the way to sustainable development, investing in infrastructure, attracting foreign investment, doing technologies, taking technology very seriously. If you want to learn from them, these are the two countries I would single out that we need to focus more on, understanding what they're doing and trying to emulate their efforts around economic development. Chair, you asked about what is best from the MTBBS for the poor. I would say trying to protect the level of social grants is fundamental here, to create this basic safety net. It's not transformative, but it's survivalist, it's keeping people alive, it's helping people to survive. That's very, very important.
I know that you mentioned that the Blue Oceans economy has been omitted from the MTBBS. As you respond, I want to also to touch on whether you think the fourth industrial revolution is provided for in the MTBBS. Because everybody is talking about fourth industrial revolution, but has it been provided for here? Because this is futuristic something, but that future starts now.
Sorry,
Okay. Oop.
Oopsie. You know, I've been saying Mula, I've been saying Churo. Sorry, my apologies. Okay, so Churo, then? Okay, Professor Churok. Okay, yeah, a great man indeed. Okay.
Sorry, if it's me, then...
It's you. You spoke about the blue ocean being omitted, so I'm saying, do you think the fourth industrial revolution has been provided for?
I don't think it was sufficiently provided for. We are starting at the HSRC to look at people's understanding of what the fourth industrial revolution actually is, or the digital revolution. I think more could have been said about current developments and what kind of impact that might have on jobs, so that we know how to respond to that. But I'm not a fourth industrial revolution expert, so I'm just saying I think it was missing that. Then your question on trust, it's a matter, well, first, number one is leadership, so you have to have the right leaders and in the right places. And that, you know, there's this saying, I don't even know if it's true, the fish rots from the head. So you need to make sure that you have the right leaders in place, people with integrity, who uphold constitutional values of transparency and of accountability, equality, dignity, freedom. And also, something that people see is dealing decisively with corruption. If we don't deal decisively with corruption, there will never be trust.
Add to that on the digital revolution. I had to excuse myself from an international meeting to come to this, and there were people from Singapore there, and we talked about the fourth industrial revolution and what it means for them. And they said, well, we're moving towards a smart society. And so I said, well, what does that mean, a smart society? And it's a whole process, and of course everything is digital communication, no paper, and it's supposed to be all the other efficiencies on it. So I think the fourth industrial revolution or the digital revolution has many dimensions. One is, what does it mean for a new way of working in public sector or in any sector? And of course, if it works well, there's certain efficiencies, but it means lots and lots of retraining of people, gaining a whole new different set of skills. And private sector will move towards different ways of operating, but they have a faster response time and abilities to retrain and reskill people in order to participate in this different way of operating. Globally, the societies are moving towards a digital world, and South Africa will have to also start preparing for that world. But at the same time, we also have to, what I've said, you know, we've got to deal with 4IR, and we've got to deal with 4Rs, like reading, writing, numeracy, kinds of skills. So the challenge is to hold both the realities together. But we have to start preparing for the digital revolution and world.
No, thank you.
right, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll just put something in. So, Prof, you don't have any
No, not at the moment, thank you.
What about the link of the course is that we will be commissioned with the budget?
Sorry, yeah, we... I mean, in our work, we've been focusing on the mandate in the money bill, and we didn't see that as something directly related. I mean, I think it's something that needs to be part of government policy and thinking how developmental state works on those issues, and then whether it's in a mandate paper or some other structure to look at how you prioritize spending related to those issues. But at the moment, we don't have any, we haven't done any research, or we don't have any comments on that. Thank you.
The other key stakeholder is National Treasury. You know, I realize that you joined us 1 hour after we started. We really appreciate the teacher to improve on that. You know, there are many interpretations that the people can come from, but we don't have to just pray that they were going to be the
teacher. Thank you, Chairperson. Well, I should apologize for being late. In my mind, this was starting at half past 10. Now I only realize it's 10 o'clock, that it's half 9, so I really had to add it here. Perhaps one could make a comment on the wait list. And our assessment of the problem is that this is not really about bloating in terms of the headcount. What we will do with more people, there's no doubt, especially around the developing areas, health and education, and the social development kind of thing. We really need more people there. I think our problem is that the earnings growth of government services is that so fast. We are paid so much more, even by international standards. So our employees are paid much more than at least 30% more than our peers out there, including developed countries. So that is not sustainable. So I do agree we need wage settlements that are broadly in line with inflation. That's what we need. If we do that, within the next 10 years we can solve the problem. If anything, we will be back in line with our peers. But if we continue with the CPI plus 1% wage agreement, and then plus the progression factors of between 1.5% and 2%, that is CPI plus 3% growth in earnings every year. It is not sustainable, it's well over and above the nominal GDP growth. So we are taking much more out of the economy than we are putting back. It's not sustainable. So this is more about how we deal with the union, how we arrive at a viable way settlement. The CPA related agreement will affect. There is no doubt about that.
My
thing
is that this then
closes
the discussion on the issue. I'm not going to allow the CEO to give us his closing statement on the discussion.
Thank you, Chairperson. So all I want to say is thank you very much for this opportunity to come here and be really given the time for us to, from your point of view, understand what you think the pressing issues are, and for us to adequately as we can respond. There are issues that you've raised that we can't address, and I think it's really important for us to say that. We will try to be as helpful as you can. Chairperson, you've asked that we go away and we do this comparison between the budget statement and the now this midterm budget statement, and as Prof. Turok remarks, it makes us just a little nervous because the scale of it is quite intense. It does mean going to look at allocations in a line by line way, and And that might be the difficulty. And I'm not sure that we can do that easily. We will try and check this, but I'm not sure that we can easily do it and quickly. In time for you to be able to prepare for this debate. And I'm sorry that, you know, but I just think technically it's a little difficult. But that doesn't mean that we don't want to be all the systems chairperson. We'd like to be useful to our parliament, and we come here making that offer of making ourselves available as and when we can be. Thank you very much, Chair.
So you, I don't know whether I just want to check with another person, but just two sets of meetings to have in a meeting for the forum, shall we allow them to quietly walk out as we proceed the two sets of meetings? Why? Because they first. Okay, shall we proceed in the quiet time? Thank you very much.
Yes, Chair. I can never be absent. I have a very efficient office, and we would have sent an apology, and we did send an apology.
Administration, Page 5. I know members have read the minutes. Page 5, page 6, page 7. Any proposal for adoption of the minutes? Honourable Member Martins, any seconder? Honourable Member McLaughlin, yes. Move to the second set of minutes. 31st of October. The minutes were circulated, and I strongly believe that members have read them.
Yes, Chair, although I didn't attend that meeting myself, so I can't comment on the minutes themselves, I'm on page 1. It's just that I'm actually M.S. Shackleton, it says there M.M. Shackleton.
This is correct.
It's
So we are on the minutes of the 31st of October. Can we be wide awake and vigilant? Because I don't want that after we pass, we go back again. Imam. Let's focus. Well, this time around, and moving forward, I'm not going to go forward and backward. I just want to go forward forever. Alright? Okay, any corrections on page 1? On page 2? Page 3? Page 4? Page 5, page 6. Any proposal for adoption of the minutes? Honourable Member Martins, any seconder? Honourable Member Banana. Under announcement, we will be debating the Division of Revenue Bill on the 30th, and we will also have a joint meeting on. Oh, sorry, tomorrow. Yeah, the program has been...